Well, we have a treat this morning. He's been here before, for all the way from Boston, coming across the United States to be here with us, Pastor Paul Conway.
I was questioning what to share with you. Sometimes you kind of get a good word and you're like, well, that's an oracle. We kind of carry that to a bunch of places. And then other times God really puts something specific on your heart. And as much as I tried to kind of grab onto something that I'd been carrying for a long time, I felt like God was really speaking to me specifically for you as a group. I know you've been going through the book of Ruth. And so I just felt to do here today the background of the book of Ruth, to give it that much more meaning. A lot of times we really don't understand what's really going on, because the background, the stage and the setting of the book of Ruth changes the depth of what that's all about. So really, we've got PowerPoint here this morning. We got some slides, and if we get lost, they've got a manuscript up there, but if you see me go like this, that's the next one. Last time I was here, I said it's like disco church up here. So we'll do it like that. I've also just want to warn you, I had a venti from Starbucks this morning. We have mild blend on the East Coast. I'm already attention deficit hyperactivity, OS, which stands for shiny, distracted. And I am just fully amped. So I apologize for those of you that are, bless your hearts. You're nice and calm. I'm about to give New York a real bad name. Anyway, I have really one word for you this morning, and it's Elimelech. Say it with me, Elimelech. The message here is not going to be an expository message. It's going to be an expository backdrop to the entire book of Ruth to give it meaning. That's really what I want to do with you. I have one word for you, Elimelech. I really have three metaphors for you. One is an empty throne. Second is critical mass. It's that moment where there's enough sustainable energy that a nuclear explosion takes place. Empty chair, critical mass, there's one other there. I forget what it is. We'll get to it. You'll see it. An empty chair. That's it. An empty throne, critical mass, and an empty chair. And I really want to preach to you today. This will be kind of different. Almost think like we're preaching in stereo. You know how stereo kind of goes back and forth like this? I want to kind of just not just lock into one passage, but just kind of reverb in a couple of spots. It's almost going to be like parallel parking, right? Aren't you glad some of the new cars have automatic parallel parking? For those of you that have teenagers that are turning 16 or are going to be taking the car out, right? You can just pull right up and just be like, parallel park. And the thing goes, whoop, whoop. That thing that used to just like make you so angry, or you tried it no matter how hard you tried it. It's a way of life in the Northeast. And so, you know, parallel parking, you know, it's okay if you bump somebody when you're doing it. You got to create space with it. So we're kind of going to back up and move forward and back and forth into finally reaching a space here where I think God's going to create space for our lives. So that's where we're going. So let's pray. Father, we thank you for this morning. I thank you for LifePoint Church. Thank you for Pastor Andrew and all of the team members here. Most of all, we thank you for you, Lord. Without you, none of this would make sense, be possible, or have any meaning. Lord, you're not an addendum to our life. You are our life, and you are our King. And so we bow before you this morning in Jesus' name. Amen. I have a verse for you I want to read to really set the background for us. It's from Judges 17:6, and it's found in a couple of other spots, 21:25. It really shows up, this phrase, in those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It shows up literally between chapters 17 and 22 of the book of Judges about four or five times, specifically in that section, not with Samson, not with Gideon, and not the other judges, just right in this little nook here that you parallel park into. And, you know, if I were to use the phrase king, we've got a lot of baggage, right? The last king that we dealt with in our nation, we kind of kicked back across the ocean, right? And so, especially in Boston, like the Revolutionary War, 4th of July is big stuff there, because we just kind of throw the monarch back across the sea. But we have all these images of king. Here are some that come to our mind, right? We've got king number one. Now, some of you who are a little bit more have the benefit of a classical education, we've got this king right there. And then those of you who grew up in the 80s, we have this king for you. And of course, ladies, let's not forget those of you from back in the 50s and in the early 60s, here is the king for you. Those of you who have been alive to experience the trilogy of the Lord of the Rings, we have this king for you. And of course, to defend your French fries, as Pastor Rick mentioned this morning, we have this king for you this morning. Don't touch my fries. I, in fact, know who the Burger King guy was up until they started getting raunchy with those. And you wouldn't believe who it was. I can't tell you because they're the son of a very famous minister, but it's hilarious. And then when they started asking to do some inappropriate stuff with dancing, and not that dancing is inappropriate, but just he just backed off of it. But all right, anyway, you're going to be like, who is that person? All right. And then, of course, we have the ultimate deterioration of kings in America, this king right here. What's a king? I mean, it's such a blurred metaphor, isn't it? Well, really, at the end of the day, probably the best thing for a king is this image right here. How many of you watched The Royal Wedding? Every girl's a princess at heart. 3 billion people watched it live. $64 million were spent. And I love Kate Middleton. She is just out of the box. First of all, she comes from a very common family, although they made millions recently in starting a business. Up until that time, they were just workers for British Airways. And she's dating Prince William, and all of a sudden, she's like, he's not paying enough attention to me. This relation's over. And she just kind of backs off. Did you guys track that at all? She just like tells the Prince of England, like, you need to chase me a little bit harder, young man. And so she backs off, and he's like, all of a sudden the game ramps up. Can I give you some advice, those of you that are girl, you young ladies in here that are dating, and even for those of us that are married? You know, if you just give everything away, it ends the chase. You know, don't play hard to understand, but don't play easy to get either. Keep the mystery alive. Don't give away the best parts of who you are. And so she kind of did that, and she, you know, at the end of the day, it's not the quality of the crown, it's the quality of the person that wears it. And really here at this next slide, it really sums up what the book of Judges is. The book of Judges is an empty throne, Elimelech. It's a Hebrew word. And to come back to that passage that I talked about between chapter 17 and 22 of the book of Judges is really that nook where you can throw the book of Ruth kind of into. We don't know exactly where it falls. A lot of commentators will kind of tell you for sure, but it kind of falls into this spot. There is no king. It's the time of judges. Judges come and judges go. And here starts the story of a woman. Interestingly, book of Ruth is a story of a woman. Here starts the story of a woman. We don't know where her name is, but we know her son's name's Micah. And Micah shows up, and the story shows up where he comes home and he says, Mom, stole a whole bunch of silver from you. And I'm so sorry. And you know what this woman's response is, rather than disciplining her son? She says, oh, my son, the Lord be praised. I dedicate this silver to the Lord. Let's make an idol. And so all of a sudden, if you look at this picture, this next picture, they make a god and they dedicate it to an idol. You can click it to the next one there. Follow the... There it is. And what's interesting is all throughout Israel, and I'll be going there for 5 weeks in a short period of time, it's littered in this time of history. It's littered with idols. It's littered with it. And so then all of a sudden, this man makes a shrine and he has no priest. So all of a sudden, the Levite's traveling through. And he says to the Levite, who's supposed to be serving God at Shiloh, where the Ark of the Covenant is, he says to him, hey, bro, come here and I will make you my high priest. This is our God. And this would be a great thing. And the guy's like, okay. And so now he becomes an idolatrous priest, who in turn then has his own tribe coming through, the tribe of Dan. And they say, bro, we recognize your accent. What are you doing here? Aren't you a tribe? Aren't you with us? Aren't you a part of the Levite crew? And you know, we need some wisdom here. We're in the land here in the coast. We can't kick the enemy out. It's frustrating. Our kids are getting beat up constantly. What should we do? We want to relocate. And so what does your God tell us to do? And so the priest goes before the idol and says, GPS, put it up. Do, 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 pew. The north of the country is open. Go up to the area in the region of Laish and turn it into the city of Dan, and there you can go. Now understand, God told the children of Israel where their home was to be. And he said, you fight for it. And let me tell you something. In this life, there isn't anything. It has to be worth fighting for to be worth something. And he said, you take the land. You fully, completely annihilate the enemies in there. And you occupy until I come. But not Dan. They are the ultimate failure of completing the task that was left with Joshua. And so they relocate, and up in the city up there, if in this next slide, you can see literally the whole area, and we'll click through these real quick. It's almost like a whole bunch of Israelites move in, like a bunch of tent trailers, and they fill these little pits where their food goes, and later on they eventually build this gate, and they reoccupy and relocate in an area, and they just leave the enemy sitting right there at their doorstep of their brothers and sisters. You know, when we don't thoroughly deal with the enemy in our life, when we look for the easy way out, when we don't deal with our sin thoroughly, we allow the devil not just to affect us, but to move right in next to our family, to our brothers, to our sisters, to our friends, to our neighbors, and they just split. So now, while that's going on, all of a sudden, a man goes through the region, and he comes into the town, and he goes looking for hospitality, and somebody takes him into his house, and the whole town comes out and says, hey, listen, bring those people out, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. We want to have sex with them. And so all of a sudden, he says, please, please, just take my daughter and my concubine. Leave them alone. Nobody's getting my wife, let me tell you what. I don't understand why these people would just so quickly just throw people to satisfy and protect someone. They literally ravish these people, and they end up opening the door, and the girl is dead at the doorstep. Outraged, they go and they take the body and they send it to four corners of Israel, and then all of a sudden they rally the troops together, and then starts one of the greatest civil wars in Israelites' early history, and 60,000 people die as a result of that. The cycle continues so that in 1 Kings chapter 12, 28 through 31, Rehoboam decides, we don't even want to be a part of the southern part of the kingdom of Israel. It used to be said that you worship God from Dan to Beersheba, the top of the country to the bottom of the country. Now he puts an idol in the city of Dan and Bethel and cuts himself off from his family, the people of God. You know, people always say that my sin doesn't affect anyone except me. Are you out of your mind? You know, Israel had no king. Each man did what was right in his own eyes. But to think that our actions don't have repercussions and reverberating effects upon the lives that we are responsible for and that we care for is insanity. Those of us that are fathers, sons, father-in-laws, grandfathers, do you want your legacy, and not to be curt, and I know it's early in the morning, but I really feel to throw this out there, do you want your legacy to be a legacy of porn? Do you want at the end of your life someone to go through your files and someone to go through your computer and somebody to go through your stuff only to realize that you were addicted to pornography? Those of you that are mothers and mothers-in-laws and sisters, do you want your legacy to be a legacy of manipulation and meanness, that you pass on an example of how to manipulate and not esteem others higher than yourself? You see, our sin affects people. That is why it is so important that Christ is king of our life. It's crucial that Jesus, that we don't just step into the kingdom, but we allow the kingdom to step inside of us, that we occupy, that we become everything that God intended for our lives. You see, because when we don't, what we do is that we see a throne and we figure that God's not on it. And so then we put ourselves on it. That's about as insane as putting the jester on the throne. And what we do is when we don't throne God, we put the jester, we put a crown on the fool. And we make decisions that are devastating to lives around us. Devastating. There's a saying in German, it's called Gott ist tot. Try it with me, Gott ist tot. Means God is dead. Or literally the death of God. In 1966, Time magazine wrote an article that was really over 50 years of reverberation in the culture of Friedrich Nietzsche's The Death of God. And what's interesting to me is that the Holocaust not only produced some of the greatest theists and theologians, but it also produced some of the greatest atheists that came out of that culture. One of them is a man by the name of Richard Rubinstein, who wrote a book called After Auschwitz, and he began a thing called phenothanatology, which is basically a theology of the absence of God. And he begins to talk about, and he literally said this, he says, the death of God as a cultural fact is real and all-embracing. And he says that in the face of the Holocaust that he went through. How could someone say that? And yet, on the other side, you have these other great Holocaust theists like Ignaz Maibohm, Eliezer Berkowitz, David Weiss, Halevina, and you try pronouncing these Hebrew names, they're just difficult. But it just blows my mind. And when I look at our country, when I look at the time that we live in, friends, we live in the time of judges in our nation. We live in a time where there is no king, and each one does what seems right in his own eyes, and we look to elected officials as the next deliverer to bail us out. And we go through this cycle where we learn to cope without God, and then we cry out to God for a deliverer, and then we go to the polls, and we ask for him to change the situation, and then just as soon as everything goes good, we forget our God. And you can track that with all of the cycles of how in times of war, it's September 11th and all of those, how quickly the church fills and how quickly it empties by that cycle. And you would think that we would have learned from communism. You've got Joseph Stalin, who interpreted Karl Marx's works as if it was religion was a threat to communism. And so he determined that he would wipe the concept of separation of church and state came from Stalin. He decided that he would separate them, and he made a vow that the Bible would be irrelevant and non-existent on the face of the earth, and set out a propaganda that would totally remove the Bible from the face of the earth. And then the Berlin Wall fell. And then millions of copies of the Bible flooded into Russia, literally where people were fighting for Bibles. See, the reality is that there is a God, and there is a king, and his name is Jesus. And although you cannot see him physically seated on that throne, he is on the throne. Listen, God's always been king, regardless of who ignores him. And the truth is that one day every knee will bow, every tongue will confess, and it will be done either out of adoration for him or by force. He's God. He's God. And that brings us to Ruth. Really, this is the hinging, the book of Ruth is the hinging moment of the whole theology of the book of Judges. And literally, it's intended to be passed to us in that way, because Ruth is literally, the book of Ruth and her life is the slap in the face to an empty throne. She comes up and says, no, your God is my God. When all of the people in the kingdom lost hope in God, a woman from outside of that kingdom, a Moabitess, stands up and embraces that king with all of her might. When she had nothing to hold on to, nothing to look forward to, nobody to count on, she looked out at Naomi, who was in despair. She looked in at her own sorrow, and somehow she looked up and caught a glimpse of God on the throne and said, your God will be my God. I don't know if when she was saying that she was looking up or as much as she was looking out at Naomi when she said that. But something changed in this woman that she latched onto God. She couldn't see it, but it was as real as she could touch it. And that really brings us to a passage in Ruth where it says this in Ruth 1:1-2. And it came to pass in those days when the judges judged, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn into the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons, and the name of the man was Elimelech. And the name of his wife was Naomi, and the name of his two sons was, Mahlon and Chilion, but it's actually pronounced Mahlon and Kilion. Just sounds better in Hebrew. And Naomi. You know what's interesting? In any of the books of the Bible, especially the Gospels or some of these stories that are written, usually the first few chapters, they're going to tell you exactly where they're headed with the story. And the names of these people is crucial to understand what's going on. Literally, Mahlon there means sick. And his other son, Kilion, means to be finished and come to an end, to die. If I don't know about you, but I'd be upset if my mom said, we shall call you sick and we shall call you dying and dead. I'll make sure to live up to that name, Mom. Low expectations there. And Naomi means pleasant, the pleasant one. But Elimelech is the king name of that entire book because it means this: Elim, my God. Melech is king. Elimelech, my God, is king. In a time in Israel where there was no king and each man did what was right in his own eyes, a family gave birth to a son and said, my God is king. I don't care what they think outside of the four walls of my home. I don't care that there seems to be no one on the throne. I don't care everybody's doing it. I don't care whether I'm marginalized for thinking this way or not. I don't care that there is none of that. There is a king in Israel. My God is king. And I will serve him. And that family, I don't know how that name came about, but they dug their feet in. And what's interesting about Israel and the throne of God is that the throne was the Ark of the Covenant. There was never anybody on that throne physically, ever. In fact, it sat behind a veil, and they believed that between the wings of the cherubim that were carved in gold on it, that God would come down and would sit, and that the angel's wings would be the backrest for it, and that that throne from there, God himself was king of Israel. In fact, in the days of Pompey, when he came in and he destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, he walked in and the priests were sitting there worshiping and they were killing them. They were waiting for God to swoop in. And he walks in behind the curtain and he steps in and he looks and he's confused. He's perplexed because in his culture, there are giant edifices of gods and statues and all kinds of ornate designs overlaid with gold. And he walks in to look at the king in the presence of the great God of the people of Israel. And there's nothing there. See, Helen Keller said this. She said, the only thing worse than being born blind is having eyes and still not being able to see. See, because friends, we serve a God who is invisible, immortal, powerful, omnipresent, all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful, and he sits on that throne, and he is our God. And you know what? The truth of the matter is that in life, if you're going to say, my God is king, you need to be willing to serve God at critical and painful moments. Look at this verse here in Ruth chapter 1, 11 and 16 and 17. It says this, but Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? We always read this verse, right? Sometimes I hear King James. I don't know. I picture King James with somebody running around with a harp and a lyre and rose petals like, where art thou going? You know, and it's just kind of, I picture that this was kind of spoken like this, where she says, just turn back, my daughters. She probably just couldn't even get the words out. She's just like, just go, leave me. It's over. But Ruth steps up and she says, don't you urge me to leave you or return. Don't you do it. Don't urge me to stop following you, for where you will go, I will go. Where you stay, I stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. And may the Lord do to me, and more so, if anything, but death parts me from you. That's commitment. That's serving God at the critical moment. See, life is a series of critical moments. And in order to break through a critical moment, you need to have critical mass. That's really what makes a nuclear detonation possible. The nuclear fusion, the energy builds up to a certain point, the substance is there sustainable enough, and the byproduct of that is a nuclear detonation that engulfs everything within its path. You hit critical moments, right? Think about the critical moments and the critical questions you ask that will determine years of your life. Where am I gonna live? What is my career gonna be? What causes are you gonna serve? And Ruth hit that critical moment with that critical mass. Listen, in the ancient world, if you were a widow, it was over. All you had to do, all you had for your hope was to beg and hope that somebody would give you a pinch of bread or a few pennies, just so that you could go day to day. And at that moment, listen, at that moment, Ruth was young. We know she was beautiful because Boaz is pursuing this woman. Her mother, all the descriptions of her infer that she is a beautiful young woman. She had a life she could have turned and gone back to her people. And instead, she makes a lifelong decision of poverty to care for her mother-in-law because nobody else will care for her. That God would give daughter-in-laws like that again. That don't cut off their mother-in-laws, but invite them in. And that God would give us mother-in-laws that don't draw a circle to keep people out, but have no circle to bring all people in and treat them with equal respect. And this decision that she would do would start a chain reaction that would go through millennia, because the byproduct of Ruth making this decision will eventually bring us to the end of the book, where it says that Ruth gives birth to Obed, and Obed gives birth to Jesse, and Jesse gives birth to David. And David and his offspring gives birth to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, Jesus Christ. You see, the funny thing is most of us miss those moments in life, the critical moments, because we're not looking for them. Or we just go through life laissez-faire, or maybe we go through life with an empty throne, and we just kind of are more like deists, like God left it in our hand and he split. Instead of doing what the book of Kings said those kings who failed to do, to say that they inquired of the Lord. To have a life that would inquire of the Lord. Probably the most greatest critical moment in history was the Garden of Gethsemane. And there's Jesus at that critical moment, a moment that actually will determine eternity for all humanity. And he's sitting there in the garden. And listen, those critical moments, I would like to say to you that we get ready for those moments. Your critical moments, you'll never be ready for them. You'll never be able. You'll never be holy enough. You'll never be strong enough. You'll never be good enough. And there, the Son of God is on his knees, dripping so intensely blood and sweat mixed, crying out to his Father, knowing he had a purpose from day one. And he says, God, he says, Father, if you're willing, please take this cup from me. Take it from me. Right in that spot where their garden is, you literally can climb up to the top of the mountain, and over there is the Judean wilderness, where you can literally disappear. I could go in there right now and the Israeli Defense Force couldn't find me for months. It's that kind of place with canyons and twists and caves, and it's filled with history of people who resisted Rome and Greece and all kinds of other empires. And Jesus is sitting there. He knows that Judas has betrayed him. He knows the cross is before him, and he offers up a prayer and he says, God, this is my critical moment. Not my will, thy will be done. And he could have split over that mountain. Ruth was standing there in front, and listen, Ruth and Jesus were saying the same thing in different ways. Not my will, thy will be done. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. I'm not going to split on you. I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to forsake you. I'm going to go through that critical moment and fulfill the purpose that God has for my life. Will you split from your critical moment? Or will you allow God? Gethsemane means oil press. It was the pressing moment of Jesus. The way that they would make the anointing oil, they would press olives, and then they would put in all kinds of ingredients. But one of those key ingredients was myrrh. And myrrh, they would go up to the tree and hit the tree with a stone. And all night through the dark of the night, it would drip and bleed myrrh. And the interesting thing about myrrh is this: it smells beautiful, but it tastes absolutely disgusting. Some of the most anointed, beautiful, God-ordained, powerful moments of your life, you won't even recognize are happening until it goes past, because they're moments of myrrh gathering where God pounds the side of your life. He presses you in an oil press and squeezes the very essence of who you are. And you're like, my God, why have you forsaken me? And God says, I haven't gone anywhere. I'm on the throne. I'm here in your suffering. I'm here to help you. And if you will trust me, it's at that moment that God looks for us in our suffering and our difficulty, not to say I'm out of here, but to say, Elimelech, my God is king. My friend's grandfather, he thought he was meeting his end in a heart attack. And as he was gasping for air, he did this. He went, God is just. My God is king. He was going to leave this world with God's words on his tongue, affirming the goodness of God. And so many of us in our difficult situation, we shake our fist and we look over our shoulder and we look for the way out. And what God is saying is, hold on, hold tight, that this isn't the end of the kingdom. That weeping endures for a night and joy comes in the morning. One of those people that reminds me of Ruth in our recent history is a woman by the name of Lillian Thrasher. You could just skip forward to this. Lillian Thrasher really is like a Ruth who faced a critical moment and a critical mass in her life. In fact, no one would have thought much of her in the early 1900s. In fact, she fell in love with this wonderful young man, Tom Jordan. He felt called to be a pastor, and she loved him. They were engaged, and she was serving in orphanages throughout her young years, and she was serving in one near where they were courting each other. And she went up to him, and she said, Tom, I really feel called to Egypt. And he said, well, Lillian, I feel called to the pastorate, and I feel if you just come on under here and we join together, we could really do great things for God. And she said, but I can't get away from this haunting pull. God has called me to Egypt. I can't do it. 10 days from the day of their wedding, she calls it off. Against the will of her parents, she puts $100 in her pocket and takes her sister. So really, it's $50 each. And she hops on a boat. Where was she going? She didn't know where she was going. Listen, I can't tell you what happened to Tom Jordan, but I can tell you what happened to Lillian Trasher, who said Elimelech. She lands in there, and she hits her second critical moment, which is a baby. She goes in, and she didn't know what she was doing. She'd admit she never knew what she was doing. And she goes, and she's taken to visit a family, and there's a woman who is dying, and a translator is translating for her in from that language. And she says she's going to die, and so to keep the baby from suffering, she's going to throw it in the river. She says, oh, don't do that. I'll take the baby. Critical moment, critical mass. She takes that baby, and the chain reaction begins. She goes back to the missionary station where she was staying. These two missionaries said, let's take her in out of pity. Not much will come of it. All of a sudden, the baby starts crying. Baby starts smelling. Baby starts doing what babies do. And they said, this is a mission station. We can't have babies in here. They're trying to do the work of God. It's an oxymoron. What does she do? She has nowhere to go. She has nowhere to go. She's got a baby of a mom who's probably dead by now, a group of missionaries who should be supporting her but aren't, no financial support like we have with people in on the back of the wall and giving them money each month. She has nothing. She didn't know what to do, but she knew how to pray. And she began to pray. And as she began to pray, God opened up a place, and she started and she took in 50 children. And then by the time of her death towards 1961, each year that place was housing 1,200 children. Children returned with their children, and they would come back and say, I want you to meet your grandma. And they would look at him, and they look at her, and they look at her, and they look at him. And they'd be like, she doesn't look like us. She said, that's your grandma. She raised me. You get it right. She's your grandma. She became known as the mother of Egypt. Listen, she is somebody who said, Elimelech, my God is king. So many times people have eyes, but they can't see that God is on the throne. Jesus didn't say he came to take the trouble out of life. He promised that we would overcome this life. And I encourage you this morning, whatever your situation is that you're facing, hang on, hold on, push through, believe God. He's going to help you. You know, the disciples really met this question of Elimelech. They got it. What a bunch of clueless guys, huh? I'd have fit in perfect with them. I'm kind of like one of those guys, you know, the joke is out, and then all of a sudden I'm like, what? And then 2 minutes later, all of a sudden I start embarrassingly laughing out loud, and everybody's like, what is he laughing at? Oh, you finally got it. Okay. And you know, where you think that when Jesus throws something out there, you look for the opportunity, the edge, you know? And so what's in it for me, and how's this going to work out? And so all of a sudden, one of them walks up, John and James, the two broskies there, they walk up to him. They go, hey, question, big guy, when you come into your glorious throne, may one of us sit to your left and to your right. And Jesus said, hello. Now, this is really hilarious. If you look at the Gospels, you know, this way, Mark shows them real manly coming up, but Matthew says that their mom asked the question. If you need your mom to ask a question of if you're ready to lead, you know, could you please just get back in the kiddie seat and just like, let Jesus be in control. Mom, go ask him. Go, my boys. I mean, and it's a mom. Listen, mom, no disrespect to you moms that are here. You just were so proud. My kid is so wonderful. And some of us, we only have a face only a mother could love, you know. And she just loved her boys. They didn't get it. Jesus responds like this. He says, you don't know what you're asking. Hey, what are you, dumb or something? Hello. I mean, like, they just went, shoo. He says, excuse me, can you drink the cup I'm going to drink and be baptized in the baptism that I'm going to be baptized in? And how many of us, like, in ignorance, we just respond to those questions? We hear things preached, like, we really understand. We're like, amen, you know. Jesus is like, oh, my goodness, this guy's. It's teaching time. Let me help these boys out. And so he goes on and he begins to say this. It says, and Jesus called them to him and said to them, You know that those who are considered to be rulers of the Gentiles rule it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be the greatest among you must be a servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This concept of find your life, you have to lose it. To live, you first must die. To be the greatest, you have to be the servant. Isn't it kind of like in our circles, we use servant as like kind of like we don't know what else to say about him, so we just, isn't it just, he's such a servant. He's such a servant. I'll never forget a friend of mine. We were talking with a particular individual who was candidating for a significant position. And he knew this person from another position, and I just won't give any details because you just never know how big the viral podcast world is, but it's nobody in your circle of influence. But I said, hey, bro, they're thinking of this individual for this great position. He's like, oh, okay. And I know when my friend talks like that, I know what kind of guy he is. I'm like, all right, you need to unpack this for me. Come on, bro, I can handle it. You know, I'm not like, give me the gossip, but I'm like, shoot straight with me. I'm New Englander. I'm like, just slap me with it. So he says, I've got these friends in town. They're not Christians. You know what? We always ask the question. We say, how many people do you know who aren't saved? That's the wrong question. You know what the right question is? How many people who are not Christians call you their friend when you're walking away? That's the right question. So I asked one time this lawyer who would go to the local Starbucks about him. And he said, that guy's a minister? I'd never go to his church. He goes, that guy walks in, and all he does is talk about his money. He wears suits is fancier than some of the high-end lawyers that I have. And the Starbucks attendants hate him because he sits there and talks to them about Jesus and leaves his trash for them to clean up every week. We get this thing so backwards. You know what? I don't see Donald Trump and Warren Buffett saying, we're going to valet park everyone's cars at the Empire State Building today. Just bring it in, hop in. I'll valet park that for you. No, what do the people in our society do? The ones that lord it over, they remove themselves more and more from society. Jesus said, if you want to serve this kingdom, if you want to have a high position in this kingdom, you don't disengage and are called to entitlement. You re-engage, you consider the price tag, and you become servant of all. Because listen, my God is king. In a time where there is no king and everyone does what seems right in their own eyes in a nation like this, nobody is crying Elimelech. But if you cry Elimelech, you're basically saying there is one Lord and I'm not it. There's one king and I'm not it. There's one to be served and I'm not it. Because the Son of Man did not come to be served, but he came to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And that's a king I can follow. I'm so tired of having to follow people that point the way, that lead me into life like a pawn so that I can get flicked off the board for the greater cause. You know what I love about Jesus? Jesus kind of puts me behind him and says, you get behind me. I got this one covered. He says, you're going to suffer a lot, but watch me suffer first. I'm going to ask you to serve, but hand me that towel and that bowl. I'll scrub your toes. I'll follow a king like that any day. Are you acting like a kid of the kingdom? You know, we say, oh, I'm a child of the king, you know, and you hear that a lot in the South. I'm a child of the king, praying for good parking spots and praying that stock rises and praying this and praying that. And I'm a child of the king, I'm going to lose everything, but bless God. We got it so backwards. You see, because we're living for this life, aren't we? See, this is just training for eternity. One of the last critical moments I want to close with here. Really critical moment in world history would have been the Holocaust. At a time where there was no king and each one did what was right in their own eyes. Each year I go to Israel, I go to a place called Yad Vashem, which is the second largest Holocaust museum in the world. And Schindler's List, in fact, is there. I had the privilege back in the early 90s to befriend a woman by the name of Ili Eliash. She was in the ghetto. She's Jewish. Her husband and her were in the ghetto. They knew that what was going to happen eventually. And it was interesting, you know, Christians were the ones that helped significantly. And a Christian family said, give us your baby and we will smuggle your baby out and bring it to the United States. And so one night at risk of life, she went to the fence and they managed to get that baby out. Her husband eventually went to Auschwitz. She eventually didn't end up going to the concentration camps, but managed to get out. She reunited with her baby. Her husband survived Auschwitz, and they were reunited in the United States. When Israel became a nation, she was part of that group, that initial group with Ben-Gurion at the forming of the Knesset and the forming of Israel as a nation. And yet she was just as simple as could be. But I could not picture people going through that experience, praising God left and right. And the interesting thing about critical moments is that it's easy to lose heart. It's not easy. Naomi comes back to Bethlehem, and they say, it's Naomi. She had a reputation that lived up to her name. It's the pleasant one. She turns around, she says, don't you call me Naomi. You call me Mara, because God has dealt so bitterly with me. See, difficulties in life will make you either bitter or better. She was just, and listen, there are dark hours of the soul. Don't you come down hard on somebody who's suffering. God has a tough shoulder. He can handle a hit from his kids once in a while. A true man isn't determined by how hard of a punch he can throw, but how hard of a one he can take and not throw one back. God can handle it. But she was just at the critical moment, and she had nothing left to give. And Ruth said, get behind me. I'll step up to this moment. And she steps into that situation. A situation really in a person that reminds me that Ruth steps up to the moment, and Corrie Ten Boom steps up to that moment in the Holocaust. She, in some ways, Corrie would tell you that she was both Naomi and Ruth in one. Towards the end of her life, she was living with the president of our school at that time, Ben Crandall. She'd call herself God's vagabond. She'd just kind of go around real simple. She'd always have this latch hook she was doing. Remember the days of latch hook, right? Bringing back the 70s. Latch hook, that was like cool when you were a teenager. You just kind of, you know, home ec, you did it. And she would do this one that she was always working on. She would show the bottom of it and just all the knots, the back end of it, confusing. She would say, in this side of life, life looks like this. She would flip it over. And on the other side was a crown. She says, what seems like confusion and knots and difficulty is being woven into a crown for the glory of God. Don't let life bump you out of the box. Don't let life lift your knee off the ground in homage to God, she would say. See, her father, when she was young, her father used to take her to the train station, and they would go down to the train station, and her father would buy the tickets. And as they were in line, she'd be like, Dad, can I have the ticket? Can I have the ticket? Just wait, Corrie, just wait. Dad, but I want the ticket. I want the ticket. Just wait, Corrie, just wait. And inevitably, every time they did this, just before the attendant came to take the ticket as they were getting on, he would turn to Corrie and hand her the ticket. And she would turn with a smile on her face like a little girl and just hand that. And he would tear it, and she would hop on the train. Just before they parted ways, or so the story goes, as I recall it from Dr. Crandall, before they parted ways, and he was going to be taken away from her, never to be seen again, to the concentration camp. He said, Corrie, do you remember the train? Yes. God doesn't give you what you need ahead of time because you'll lose it. And he doesn't give it to you late so that you're left out. But he will give you what you need at that right moment. And her father was taken, and her sister went to the concentration camp. And Corrie was not the brave soul that everyone would think she was. She was actually the doubter. She was the angry one. And one of the SS soldiers murdered her sister. And she saw this. And she would fantasize about killing that soldier. And interestingly enough, she actually got out by accident. They accidentally wrote a number incorrectly, and she was released. That's how she got out. And years later, she's traveling the world and sharing Christ to the four corners of the world, sharing the King and his kingdom. She's in, I think it was Argentina, and somebody comes up to her and says, do you remember me? She looks, and all of a sudden, this wave of emotion hits her. At first, it was anger, and it was that SS soldier that killed her sister. Everything within her, all those years of feelings, I couldn't imagine. She looks back at her and she says, I've given my heart to Jesus. Will you forgive me? And it was only by the grace of God that God was able to touch her in such a heart that said, yes, I forgive you. Elimelech. See, in this life, there are going to be things that are going to scream at you and say, God isn't on the throne. God's not in control. And it's at that moment, like Ruth, in the critical moment, we need the critical mass in our life for a chain reaction. Corrie Ten Boom, Lillian Thrasher, Ruth, Jesus, people who met their critical moment with critical mass that had an impact that has rippled down hundreds, and in Jesus' cases, all eternity. See, right now you think maybe your life is to achieve a certain point of success, a certain level of peace, a certain moment of that. And sometimes the greatest works that God does through our life are the myrrh moments, are the Gethsemane moments. And what seems to you like a confusing weave of knotted, jaded, poor situations, God is weaving in heaven a crown, not for you to wear, not for you to sit to the left and the right, but for you to take off of your head and lay before him and say, Elimelech, my God is king. I'd like to ask a strange request as we transition from this into communion. I'd like for us to kneel, if that's physically possible. Imagine this. There's coming a day where we're going to do this. It's just a gesture of faith that we're going to do this in obedience to God. Listen, we either do it in obedience to God ahead of time, or a world that will be forced to do it in submission. And here's what I'd like for us to do is we embrace communion today. And as Pastor Rick transitions us into this, if you've been fighting the cup, if you've been shaking your fist and saying, where were you, God? That you'd remember two things that Jesus said, drink ye all of it. And that the commitment of your heart, and maybe this is for the first time in your life, say, God, I don't know who you are. I don't see you on the throne. But if you're real, you need to make yourself real because I'm at a critical moment in my life. Lord, right now in the name of Jesus across this place.